Hello, everybody. Can you hear me all right? Yeah, good. Thank you so much for inviting me. And it's a hard act to follow. I was particularly moved by Kate's answer to the last question, the Daily Mail question, such an erudite response. Okay, so it's my pleasure to tell you about Sanctuary Hosting. I'm going to tell you what we are, how we came about, what we do, why I think it works, and how you might help us. So what we are is a hosting scheme. What does that mean? So we match hosts with guests. Guests are defined by us as people who are seeking sanctuary. That could be a refugee or an asylum seeker or some other vulnerable migrant who, for reasons other than economic, can't go home. And they need to be homeless, okay? And hosts are people who've got a spare room in their house that they're willing to let someone use free of charge for a finite period. Normally it's a minimum of 2 weeks, but it might be a month or 2 months, and some go for longer. So we match guests with hosts, and that's what we do. And essentially, we're enabling the community to make a compassionate response to this problem. How did it come about? How it came about was we started off relaunching Oxford City of Sanctuary, and then we got a lot of interest, and we thought, well, what can we do that no one else is doing? And we asked ourselves the question, or rather we told ourselves, serve first those who suffer most. Serve first those who suffer most. And when we looked at what was being provided in Oxford, we saw that there were lots of excellent organisations, including Asylum Welcome, of course, providing all manner of different things for refugees and asylum seekers and other vulnerable migrants. But nobody was specifically providing accommodation. And so we thought, well, that's the gap. This is in 2015. We've got homeless people on our streets, and many of whom couldn't get statutory housing. So I don't know if you know this, but there are categories of homelessness. So a refused asylum seeker or an asylum seeker, and many vulnerable migrants can't actually even go to the night shelter and get accommodation because they can't get housing benefit. So they might be housed for a day or two. They might not even be housed at all, and they're not entitled to be housed in that way. And we have people on our streets who fall into this category. So this was back in 2015, and we said, okay, let's launch the hosting scheme. We looked around the country. We saw other hosting schemes, tried to take their best practice. There aren't many. There's about a dozen around the country. And so we launched in about April 2015, and not a lot happened, has to be said. We recruited a couple of hosts, and amazingly generous people, and made one placement. And I was thinking, this is going to be quite a slow thing, but let's do it anyway. And then in September 2015, I don't know if you remember, but there was a huge demonstration in Oxford, Refugees Are Welcome, that 2,000 people came to. It was after the child had been washed up on the beach. And the crowd was asked, the crowd was told about the hosting scheme, and they were asked, would you be willing to be a host? And loads of people put their hands up. I was amazed. And I also thought, when they get back home and think about it, not many of them will approach us. And I was wrong. Thankfully, I was wrong. And since then, we've been inundated with interest. And, you know, tens of people approaching us wanting to be hosts. And really, we've been flying by the seat of our pants ever since. So we now have over 50 sets of approved hosts. We've provided just under 10,000 nights of accommodation to people who would otherwise have been homeless. We've had 100 separate placements, and we've helped 60 people into independent living. 45 of whom were hosted through the hosting scheme. So the others we helped in other ways. So it's quite a small scheme, but it's also managed to do a lot. And the reason why it's managed to do a lot is on account of the amazing generosity of our hosts, who are all remarkable people. So that's a bit about what we do, a little bit about how we do it. So we have a big group of volunteers. We've got about 40 volunteers now. We've got two part-time members of staff. We've recently been quite successful in getting a big lottery grant to expand the scheme so that it's no longer just in Oxfordshire, it's in Bucks and Barks as well. And the volunteers and the staff appraise host applications. So we check out that people are, suitable for housing sanctuary seekers, and we help to train them to do that. And we do the same for the guests. We check out that actually they can cope with being in an English family, and that they don't have problems that are so deep seated that they wouldn't really be able to cope. And then we match the host with the guest, and we support both the host and the guest during the placement, and then we help the person to go to the next placement and so on. So that's how it works in a practical basis. And most of it's done for free by volunteers, although, as I say, we've now got two part-time staff. So I want to give you, as Kate did, I want to give you some examples, because I think that does bring it to life, some examples of people we've helped, some of whom have given their consent, and the others we've changed details so as not to compromise their confidentiality. So the first person I want to tell you about is someone I'm going to call Hamid. He's an Eritrean man who, on account of following a particular brand of Christianity, got imprisoned in Eritrea. So some forms of Christianity are okay in Eritrea, and for some you get imprisoned. The prisons are horrible. His family clubbed together to bribe a guard to get him out of prison. He got out of prison, but having got out of prison, being a devout Christian, he wanted to continue practicing, and of course that would have risked being sent straight back to prison. So they smuggled him out of Eritrea. He managed to get to Calais. He made several attempts to get over to this country. Eventually he got over by hanging onto the bottom of a lorry. He got to this country, he applied for refugee status. He was sent up north where the accommodation is, housed by subcontracted business that uses derelict houses to house refugees, and stayed there for about 3 years. During that time, he managed to get refugee status. And, of course, this is a poisoned chalice. It's what everybody wants, refugee status, permission to remain in this country. But at the point of getting refugee status, he was also told that his accommodation, he could only stay in the accommodation for another month, and that the benefits that he'd been receiving via the Home Office would stop, and that he had to apply for mainstream benefits, which in the long run is a good thing. But because of bureaucracy, it doesn't quite overlap. So he had a problem and became homeless as a result. He couldn't get enough money to get himself accommodation. And so he found himself homeless in this country, in this town up north. I went to the bus station, and this is a kind of answer to why people come to Oxford. He looked at the buses, and the only one that he recognised the place on the front of the bus was Oxford, and he used his last few pounds to buy a one-way ticket to Oxford, landed up in Oxford, and became homeless and destitute. And he didn't know about the hosting scheme. He found out about us on day 4 of being homeless, and we were able to take him in straight away into a family. He was immediately welcomed. The family had young children that he loved to be around, And he was hosted altogether for about 6 months, I think. I think three people in total hosted him. He learnt the language, he learnt the culture, so he learnt to eat the way we eat. He learnt to say please and thank you a lot, which of course we're obsessed with in this country. He learnt other things like how important it is to be punctual, how to go for an interview, how you have a right to demand a contract and that sort of thing. All of that he was helped with by his hosts. So he was helped to integrate into the country. And then at that point, he got a job and he was able to move out into independence and we helped him to pay the rent and so on. So that's one example. Another one is an example of a young man whose family was bombed when he was eight and he lost his immediate family as a result of a war situation. And he was looked after for a few years by the extended family who clubbed together again to send him to this country. So he arrived at this country age 13 and was put into foster care and went into mainstream schooling. He had been illiterate and innumerate, so he learnt to read and write and to speak English, and he was very, very bright, and he did extremely well. He did got good grades. And then at the age of 18, he was already doing part-time work. He had his own car, and his status came up for review, which it does when people get to adult age, and he was turned down. And at that point, he didn't have much money, but he carried on by sleeping in his car. And then eventually the car had to go. And so he was sleeping rough. And he'd been sleeping rough for about 4 or 5 months when he came into the scheme and had completely lost his self-esteem. And when I took him to meet the hosts, he said he didn't want to be fed because he didn't need feeding. It wasn't worth feeding him. So he's now been in the scheme for about 2 years. And he's one of those that we are continuing to campaign for him to be considered. We're doing what advocacy we can. But it's very difficult to know the way forwards with him. There is a danger that he could be deported at any point. We are making sure that he's getting every support and all the advocacy he can, but without us, he would definitely be homeless and maybe he wouldn't be alive. I'll just tell you about one other quickly, actually two others. One is a Fijian man by the name of Simone, who's given his permission for us to tell you his story. He came to a funeral of his brother in this country, and during the funeral he collapsed with kidney failure. And as a result of that, he was hospitalised and had to start having kidney dialysis twice a week. He applied for permission to remain in this country so that he could continue with his treatment, and he was refused. But he didn't want to go home to Fiji because in Fiji there's no national health service and you have to pay for kidney dialysis and the fee is huge and he couldn't afford it. So he didn't want to go home, but he was also being told he couldn't stay here. And when he came out of hospital, he was made homeless. So he was going for kidney dialysis twice a week and he was homeless. And some hosts took him in and we subsequently advocated, or rather arranged for others to advocate on his behalf. He got status. He's been given permission to remain. Subsequent to that, he had a kidney transplant and he's now living successfully, independently, and he has a job. The last one I would tell you about is a young woman who was trafficked out of an Eastern European country and imprisoned in a house in Italy where she was being used for sex. And she escaped from that, got all the way back to her country, and the traffickers caught up with her again and brought her back to the house. She then escaped from that again, and this time she didn't go back to her home country, but she came to Britain via Calais again. Arrived in this country. On her way to Calais, she'd had a casual sexual encounter and become pregnant. And we got phoned up by a midwife on a Friday night saying, I've got this woman who's 8.5 months pregnant and she's homeless and she's got no permission to be in the country. Can you help us? So we went out and spoke to her, and that night she was housed by an octogenarian host who happened to be a retired midwife. And she's still... Actually, there's several hosts working together, and she's still in the hosting scheme. She's had the baby. There are lovely pictures of her sitting under a Christmas tree just before the baby was born, opening these parcels full of nappies, which kind of various different neighbours had got together and provide for her. So she's still in the hosting scheme, and we're hoping she'll be accepted in the country. That's still in process. So that's some examples. Why do I think it works? Well, there's various reasons for this, but the main one is that it's community-based. So rather than someone being sent to a hostel where they don't get to experience the culture at all, they don't get to integrate at all, they're coming into the culture, and they're giving it gives local people the chance to do something about this crisis. And I think one of the problems we have in this country is that we suffer from empathy fatigue. You know, we see these images on the TV every night. You know, an average of 12 people a day drown in the Mediterranean trying to get to safety. We see these images, we see the war-torn countries. And then it moves straight on to the weather and the football. And empathy, where we identify with the person's suffering, empathy is a really painful emotion to allow ourselves to feel. And so I think people block it out. And that's why we have the Daily Mail reaction, I think, is because people can't cope, actually, with making that emotional identification. So I would say there's a different thing also to empathy, which is compassion, which is what I would say is empathy plus action. And they've wired people up on brain machines so that you can actually see now where these emotions occur in the brain. And empathy occur, the places that light up in your brain are all around the pain centres in the brain, which kind of is what you'd expect, I guess. When we identify with someone's suffering, it's painful. But when they've done experiments and asked people to think compassionately, what would you do for this person, then even just thinking about that suddenly lights up lots of other areas in the brain as well, many of which are associated with pleasure as well. And the empathy centres are still lit, but other centres are lit up too. And I think the trouble is that we're not given the opportunity to do that. And one of the things this scheme does is it allows people to find a way of acting and to convert their empathy into action, which is so transforming and so important. It also works well because it means that refugees and asylum seekers are no longer an abstract person. They're no longer a number. They're actually just a person within the community. And when we get to meet them, we see they're just normal people. They're just ordinary people like you and me. They're not terrorists. You know, they're ordinary people, and ordinary people who've suffered a lot. And that can help to change the narrative and the debate about the whole thing. Is when you know a few refugees and asylum seekers, when you've met a few, it shifts things. And by bringing them into the community, by having hosts who have friends that they invite round to supper to meet the person and so on, the word spreads and people begin to understand that actually we can be merciful. We can extend a hand of help. The other thing that I think is really important about the scheme is that it's modelling a way to do it that doesn't cost the taxpayer huge amounts of money, and that also doesn't take housing stock from anyone else. You know, we're creating a new resource here. So we're not taking housing away from a homeless British person who you know might need it. So we're not undermining anyone else's fortune. We're creating a new resource. So that's a bit about why I think it works, and I'm just going to finish by saying a little bit about how you might help. And there's four ways. Okay, the first way is you could apply to become a host, and we understand that most people aren't able to do that. I'm not a host myself. Most people don't have a spare room, or maybe for whatever reason they don't feel they can cope with that. And they are remarkable people. I would say, though, that you know it's not, often not what people think it is. It can be for just a short period of over 2 weeks, but you know it could be for just 2 weeks. And the host is the boss, so they can say how long they want the person to stay, and they also set the rules. Do we share meals? What happens about keys? That sort of thing. And the other thing is, we've heard back from the hosts. Perhaps it's converting the empathy into compassion. I've lost track of the number of times hosts have said, this is the most wonderful thing I've ever done. You know, I'm so glad I'm able to do this. It's been such a rewarding experience for me. It's been a two-way process. The guest has contributed just as much to me as I've given to them, and so on. So people do actually find it a really fulfilling thing to do as well. But anyway, that's the first way, if you're interested. All of this can be found on our website, by the way, and there are handouts. The second way is to become a volunteer, as with Asylum Welcome, we're always welcoming volunteers. Our volunteers help to appraise the hosts and the guests, match the hosts and guests, support the guests when they're being placed. We offer training for that, and you wouldn't be on your own initially. It's done in pairs. So we have an experienced volunteer helping a newbie to learn the ropes until they're ready to be the experienced volunteer. That's how we work that system. So that's the second thing you could do. The third thing you could do is become a benevolent landlord. And this is really, really hard for us. It's actually easier for us to recruit hosts than it is to recruit benevolent landlords. What's a benevolent landlord? A benevolent landlord is someone who is willing to accept rent that is affordable on housing benefit. And sadly, in this area, most people aren't willing to do that. They want to get the going rate, which is significantly more than housing benefit. So our problem is we get people into hosting and then it's hard for us to move them on because they can't afford to pay the rent or the huge deposits that are needed. So if you were willing to rent a room at housing benefit rates to a refugee, that would be really, really helpful. And the final way that you could help us is to give us your money. what we're trying to do is to embed the scheme in the community, and so that eventually we're not reliant on grant support. And a few months ago we started a standing order scheme. So we're asking people to give £10 a month by standing order. That's three coffees a month. And we've calculated that if 350 people sign up to do that, then the scheme will be entirely financed by the community. And since launching, we've had just over 100 now have signed up. So it's gone really well, this. And we're hoping that, you know, over the next couple of years, we can finish the job, really, and have the community resolving this problem in its own way. Okay, thank you. That's all.
Thank you. May I just invite one or two
sure.
questions?
Sure, yes.
We can go on through for soup and lunch, of course.